Birth is a beautiful, powerful moment. It's hard for all involved parties. Where babies should come into this world is at the center of a heated debate. Birth in the hospital.
Yeah, let's see, Dad. You make the call. What do we got?
Or in the comfort of your own home. This is The Pulse, bringing you stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mike and Scott. Every week, The Pulse takes you inside laboratories and treatment rooms, dissecting medical procedures and understanding what new research means for all of us.
Innovation drives the creative economy.
It is the cutting edge of what modern neuroscience can do.
Brain injury survivors still are capable of doing many things.
I think there's a notion that researchers are in some sort of ivory tower.
This is my health.
We're not just a body, we're not just a head.
Robots are really just computers with motors.
The speed at which they can process information, their ability to filter.
In addition to your knee pain, you're also dealing with insomnia.
On today's show, mushrooms grow everywhere, but growing the kind that we can eat takes serious science and commitment. So much so that a Chester County farmer we're going to meet in a little while calls them his mushroom children. Also, one scientist's personal quest to make vaccines and other medications more available in developing countries. His secret weapon? Lettuce. But first, back to the business of being born. More women are choosing to have their babies at home, and that has health officials paying closer attention. In Delaware, midwives working without a permit now face stiffer penalties, including possible jail time. The new rules have had a chilling effect. Some midwives have stopped delivering babies in Delaware homes, and Tanya English has this story.
This is all about home birth and the rules for midwives in Delaware. But let's start the story in Elkton, Maryland, just across the state line.
Great. You're eating healthy.
Yeah.
How's this baby moving?
Good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like wild baby or
normal baby?
Normal baby.
Yeah.
This home office is decorated with totems to female fertility and bumper stickers with sayings like midwives help people out. Pictures of newborns and new moms cover an entire wall.
I'm Karen Webster. I'm a midwife. Sage-femme is what we're called in France. That's a wise woman. Partera, that's Spanish.
Webster has gray hair and wears red cat-eye glasses. The overall vibe is cool grandma. She raised 8 children in this house and opened her midwifery practice here 26 years ago.
Any swelling at all?
I feel like my ankles are starting to come a little early with the swelling.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Today, Webster is facing serious charges in Delaware. But before explaining all that, first, she wants to clear up some stereotypes.
We're not untrained. We're not witches. I don't know. We're not, we don't all wear Birkenstocks and, you know, not shave our legs and all that. And who cares about that? That's not what it's about. It's about your education, your qualifications.
There's a longstanding tug of war for trust and autonomy between some midwives and some doctors in the first state. The clash is over one particular kind of birth attendant. Delaware calls them non-nurse midwives.
We're typically called certified professional midwives. I'm not exactly sure why Delaware, when they passed their statute, chose to frame us in that way, non-nurse midwives. Not exactly sure, but it seems to be a step down.
You need a permit to work legally in the state. But for more than a decade, not one non-nurse midwife has been able to get a permit. To apply, a midwife needs something called a collaborative agreement. It's a contract with a Delaware obstetrician who agrees to be a backup doctor, kind of like a sponsor.
The problem with a written practice agreement is that there is implied liability. Malpractice insurance companies will drop doctors from their malpractice policy if they know that they are collaborating formally. It was never going to happen.
For years, non-nurse midwives went about their business, attending clients and home births in Delaware without a permit and without much concern. That is, until the law changed earlier this year.
The climate of midwifery in Delaware is volatile at the moment.
Sarah Culver is with a home advocacy group, Families for Safe Birth.
For a long time, the State Board of Health and the physician community has sort of looked the other way when it comes to home birth midwifery.
Less than 1% of babies in the U.S. are born at home, but there's a revival. Delaware health officials say they've documented three incidents that they call bad outcomes, involving a home birth and a non-nurse midwife. Sarah Culver says Delaware is paying close attention now.
The state's radar sort of tuned in to the underground home birth community and realized it was time for their perspective to take drastic action. And that drastic action was to make our professional midwives, who are trained and educated and credentialed, felons.
Clerk, please call roll on House Bill number 194 as amended by House Bill.
The push for tougher punishment started this summer. Yes vote after yes vote came quickly in the General Assembly.
Speaker, the roll call reveals 39 yes, 1 not voting, 1 absent.
Bill 194 as amended by House Amendment 1 is declared passed the House.
The debate was different online and at community meetings. There was more discussion, plenty of back and forth.
There are these rules that need to be followed, and they've not been followed for a long time.
We see the sad stories, the poor outcomes that are a result of home births that didn't go well.
What remedy does this family have when it comes to if something does go wrong? Who do they talk to? Who do they see? They can't take any action against the midwife because they're not licensed.
I'm the woman that's going to have a home birth with or without a certified professional midwife. That's me. And sorry, Mom, but I'm really pissed off at everybody that has taken away my right to have a professional midwife there.
The end result is that there are probably going to be a lot of people out there having unassisted home births or free births or do-it-yourself home births, whatever you want to call it, and that's a disaster waiting to happen.
Many people do want to get non-nurse midwives back to work, but no one has expressed much hope for brokering a successful collaborative agreement between a Delaware doctor and a midwife who's not a nurse.
The issue of malpractice, as much as everybody hates talking about it, comes up.
Nancy Fan is an obstetrician gynecologist at St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington.
Obstetricians make money. Unfortunately, any type of lawsuit, when it comes down to, well, what went wrong and who can we blame, they're going to go for somebody who makes some money.
Fan works with and says she trusts the training of midwives who are registered nurses, but admits that she has very little experience with non-nurse midwives. Back in Elkton, Maryland, midwife Karen Webster said the same thing.
They don't know who we are. We're not familiar to them. Our education is in taking care of normal, healthy, pregnant women, and that's what we're experts in.
Webster says she no longer helps with deliveries in Delaware, but she was in a Delaware home back in 2011 when a client gave birth to a stillborn baby. The state charged Webster with practicing medicine without a license. Webster is only facing a fine, but under the new law, with the tougher sanctions, a similar charge might mean jail time. She's fighting the charges in court and trying to set a precedent based on her belief that midwifery is not medicine.
There's a lot of territorialism, and for whatever reason, I think that they're beginning to see us as a threat, because women in increasing measure are very, very unhappy with the kind of health care they're offered in, or not offered in, the maternity care system.
Mother of two, Purusha Rivera, gave birth in a hospital the first time around.
Oh, I'm hoping for a much different experience.
Rivera says she felt bombarded by high-tech efforts to quick start her labor.
I pushed in a delivery, or in an operating room. So it was bright lights and lots of people there, and had lots of IVs, I had oxygen, all of that, along with a lot of the research that I did, is what made me make the decision to find a midwife and have a home birth.
Rivera's a little breathless when she sits down to talk during her checkup at Karen Webster's house.
I'm going to see if I can figure out where this baby is lying in here, certainly filling you up. You feel like that's shoulder there. Listening for the baby's heart rate.
Rivera's plan was to have this baby at home in Bear, Delaware, with Karen Webster at her side.
Giving birth is not the prettiest thing. And I honestly envisioned my birth being in a tub in my family room, the smell throughout the house. I had that planned. I had my aunt who was going to come over and cook, and I told her I knew it was going to be fall, and I wanted, you know, apple cider cooking in the crock pot, and just all of the things that would bring me comfort.
But then this summer, when the punishment increased for midwives working without a permit, Webster decided that professionally it was too risky to travel to Delaware. Rivera had to make a new plan.
We had to find another home outside of Delaware for us to deliver. And if I need to be in a hospital, I'm going to be there. But for a low-risk mother who desires a natural birth, this should be available.
Turns out Rivera did have a home birth. Later that same day, she delivered a healthy 10-pound baby boy in Karen Webster's living room in Elkton, Maryland. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Do you want to see what Rivera's baby boy looks like? His name is Knox, and we've got photos for you at whyy.org/thepulse. Tanya English is here now to talk a bit more about this story. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Maiken.
And Tanya, your story touches on two distinct but interwoven themes: questions about midwives' credentials and questions about the safety of home birth. And in a moment, we'll come back to the age-old tug of war between doctors and midwives. But for now, what I really want to know is home birth safe?
Mike, and as is often the case, there are conflicting conclusions about the research and lots of skepticism about the quality of the evidence that each side offers up. Several studies show that infant death rate for planned home birth is anywhere from 3 to 10 times higher than hospital birth. I spoke with Amy Tudor. She's an obstetrician-gynecologist and writes the blog The Skeptical OB. She's emphatic that childbirth in general is inherently dangerous. And when you move birth far away from the medical interventions and the professionals associated with modern obstetrics, she says the health risks go up.
The real problem here is that home birth midwives are fundamentally dishonest about the death rate at home birth. And when women don't know that home birth increases the risk of perinatal death, without that knowledge, they haven't made an informed decision.
You know, home birth advocates really counter that most babies are born healthy. And again, less than 1% of U.S. babies are born at home. And they say trying to calculate risk and estimates for such a tiny number of births is inappropriate. Some risk will always be there at home or the hospital.
Your story focuses on the state of Delaware, which is a small state, and across the nation, again, only that 1% of babies are born in the home. So why is this such a heated and national debate?
So in a lot of ways, this is a cultural war on several fronts. On one side are people who are most comfortable with a certain kind of medical or nursing training. Others are equally comfortable with other kinds of training and education. Several professional groups take the stance that women have the right to choose where they want to deliver. But this year, researchers at Cornell University concluded that doctors have a professional responsibility to counsel families against home birth. Obstetrician-gynecologist Frank Chervenak said he's worried pregnant women are getting their advice from some strange places.
We have movie stars who promote this, and to have glamorous fashion models describing the wonders of home birth, I believe this is very, very dangerous to women and the soon-to-be-born children.
So who is choosing home birth?
Again, back to Amy Tudor. This is her skeptical take.
Home birth is for white, Western, well-off women. It's an affectation. It's not a medical decision. It is, in many cases, more about how women wish to see themselves and how they like to defy medical authority than it is a true medical decision.
Tanya, again, your story focuses on Delaware. What are the rules for non-nurse midwives who typically do these home deliveries in Pennsylvania and New Jersey?
So for New Jersey, non-nurse midwives need a permit, but Pennsylvania does not offer any kind of licensing for non-nurse midwives.
Thanks, Tanya.
Thank you, Maiken.
So how did birth move from the home into the hospital and back again? And who was driving those developments? Rutgers University history professor Margaret Marsh gives us a quick tour.
All the way up to about 1760, there was no real challenge to midwives delivering babies. The midwife all your female friends, all your female relatives would come to be with you to see you through this. But it was still a scary process for women. Babies died, women died in childbirth, and so sometime around 1760, upper-class women started to want to have doctors at their births. This wasn't really driven by the doctors. It was really driven by women who thought that because doctors had more education, they could provide safer births. Doctors still delivered babies at home, but doctors increasingly delivered more babies. And in 1900, about half the babies in this country were delivered by midwives. By about 1935, only about 15% of the babies delivered in this country were delivered by midwives, because what happened in the beginning of the 20th century was anesthesia for delivering children. And women began to want to have less pain in childbirth. So they began to go to doctors, and doctors increasingly, especially in urban areas, began to deliver babies in hospitals. Now, I have to tell you, the outcomes weren't that great in the first half of the 20th century. There were lots of complications, there were lots of infections. So bringing birth into the hospital didn't really have the effect that women desired. But then, of course, you know what happened. The feminist movement happened in the 1970s, and women once again wanted to control their own childbirth experiences. And so you get the rise of the midwife once again. It was a rebellion against the male medical establishment.
Margaret Marsh is a professor of history at Rutgers University. Coming up on The Pulse, into the tube we go. A common, potentially terrifying, loud, and somehow musical medical experience. That's next on The Pulse.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, in the new Hobbit movie, composer Howard Shore writes music for a dragon. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca is focused on the discovery and development of prescription medicines to treat some of the world's most serious diseases. With its U.S. headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware, AstraZeneca operates in more than 100 countries, and its medicines are used by millions of patients worldwide. More at AstraZeneca-US.com or at the company's blog at azhealthconnections.com. AstraZeneca proudly supports WHYY's The Pulse.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Chances are you've had to do this at some point in your life. Take off all your jewelry, take a deep breath, calm your nerves, and go in. Right now, just take this sonic journey with us inside the MRI machine.
Oh, it's noisy. Very, very noisy.
It's sort of like being in a trash can while somebody is running a jackhammer.
It sounds like a washing machine with nuts and bolts in it.
It's just noisy. I don't know how else to describe it.
The most important thing it requires is to be still. There's a lot of loud noises, which sound strange, but I find When I hear the noises, they come with a certain beat, and it usually reminds me of some song. In fact, it's even possible with some creativity to make the sounds mimic a certain song. I'm professor of radiology, Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. An MRI is a method of getting pictures inside a body. It uses a magnet and it uses radio waves, so there are similarities in the physics of it to a radio that you'll listen to. But instead of detecting signals from a radio station and turning it into voice or music, this is using radio waves when a person is inside a magnetic field to make sophisticated images.
We still have about 20 minutes left.
When I'm in there, I just close my eyes and relax.
When I was in there, I panicked. I was just, stop, stop, you gotta get me out of here, because the fact that I felt closed in and the fact that the noise was just nothing that I had expected. I had to make them stop, and I didn't go back in. I regret the fact that I had to leave, because I'm trying to get better. I want to be free from this pain. I'm 65 years old, and I have trigeminal neuralgia. It's a damage to the nerve in the face. They call this the suicide pain. It is so severe, there has been times when people wanted to kill themselves. As time went on, I realized if I wanted to get healthy, I had to make sacrifices and let the fear just fade away.
It is the most effective and versatile method for looking inside a human body.
Wait, here it is. This is it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to get my bracelet off. You have to be metal-free when you go in to get the MRI. One thing I advised is to keep your eyes closed. Never, ever open them.
So you lie on a table, and it slides you inside a cylinder.
I always keep my eyes completely closed, because you don't want to see how close you are to that machine.
We are told not to move and not to speak while the scan goes on.
I pray, and I pray my whole way through it.
What I did while I was in there the last time to get through it peacefully was to meditate.
Try to think of a journey that you're going through, something that you love to do. The sun coming through the ivy and the trees, the nature, you see the animals, deer.
As thoughts come up, just letting them go, and as the sounds come up, just sort of let them be part of the breathing.
It will take away the anxiety.
It's a strange experience, but there's nothing to be scared about.
You can do this, because the end result is for you to get healthy. My name is Tony Upmorta.
I'm Dr. Donald Mitchell.
My name is Janet DeSimone.
My name is Jerry Whalen.
That audio tour was produced by Alana Gordon, and all the music featured in this piece was inspired by actual MRI sounds. We've put a playlist of MRI songs on our website at whyy.org/thepulse.
Take a picture, what's inside? Ghost imaging my mind. You're a pattern like a spider. Capillary to the center. Hold still and press a button. Looking through a glass onion.
Now time for a science news update. Joining us is Cary Grants, who will be a regular contributor to The Pulse. She is an associate editor at The Scientist magazine, and in that job, Cary reads through hundreds of new studies every week and keeps us updated on new and intriguing findings. Her picks this week: dyslexia, Mars, and Alzheimer's. Hi, Cary.
Hi, Mike, and thanks for having me.
Let's start with the study on dyslexia. This is really an attempt to better understand how the brains of people with dyslexia function.
Right. So dyslexia is a pretty common disorder in which people have difficulty reading, even though they have normal or above intelligence and normal vision. Sometimes they also have problems processing what they hear, and they see or write words in the incorrect letter order. Researchers have typically thought that the problem in the brain lied with how people with dyslexia process the sounds of speech. So what they did was they scanned the brains of adults with dyslexia and adults who were typical, and they looked at these areas in the brain, and they actually found that they were all the same. People could actually process sounds just as well if they had dyslexia as people who didn't have dyslexia. So they started to look elsewhere in the brain, and what they found was actually the connections in the brain to access these regions that were intact and perfectly operating had reduced activity. So that seems to be where the problem lies, or at least a problem in the brains of dyslexics lie. So this was quite surprising. People hadn't thought that this was the place for it.
So what does this finding mean, though, for people who have dyslexia?
Well, a little bit of understanding initially. And then secondly, of course, there are no cures for dyslexia. So people want to think about therapies. You know, in the future, perhaps people could stimulate these areas of the brain that are underperforming. Perhaps you could give them a little boost. One of the researchers who was part of the study said, you know, possibly using transcranial magnetic stimulation, that's a way to potentially boost the activity of these connections in the brain that are not as active as those connections in people who don't have dyslexia.
All right, let's move on to Mars, where the rover Curiosity found a bit of a game changer, a freshwater lake.
Right. So Curiosity is a rover. It's been cruising around Mars for about a year and a half and taking samples. And the region where it's taking samples is called Gale Crater, this big pit on the surface of Mars. And this week, scientists presented a load of evidence about an ancient freshwater lake that likely existed in Gale Crater billions of years ago. So one of the things that Curiosity found was evidence of clay. Clay suggests that there was a freshwater lake here. On top of that, Curiosity found the elements of carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, all the usual suspects when we're talking about sustaining life on a planet. So the question is that Curiosity is now going to look at is whether there might be organic carbon on the planet. And that would also, provide some good evidence that life might have existed there.
And finally, Cary, there was some news this week on Alzheimer's and one potential cause.
In this study, researchers were looking at lead. Lead is known to be neurotoxic, and any parent who has raised children in the Philadelphia region is probably familiar with the warnings against exposure to lead dust or chips in the old houses in the Philadelphia region because it can damage the brains of fetuses and young children. So researchers are now looking at whether lead exposure might also have something to do with Alzheimer's disease much later on in life. This is a study that came out in monkeys this week. Decades ago, when the monkeys were babies, researchers fed them formula that had lead in it. They also fed formula without lead to other monkeys. Then when the monkeys were 23 years old, the researchers looked at their brains and they found clumps of a certain protein in their brains called tau. And tau tangles, as people call them, are a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. The monkeys that were not given the formula with lead had much lower levels of tau. And this builds on earlier evidence that researchers found that the monkeys that were given the formula with lead also had amyloid plaques, and those are also part of Alzheimer's disease. So the question is, was it the lead that is leading to these increased levels of tau and amyloid plaques? We can't say for sure.
But if it was the lead, then is that maybe a bit of good news? Because as you mentioned earlier, we are so much more adamant about lead exposure now, and kids are not exposed to as much lead as maybe previous generations had been.
Well, of course, because we don't fully understand what causes Alzheimer's and dementia. So if there are environmental toxins that contribute to it, that would be a wonderful way to try and prevent. But of course, there's a lot of caveats to this story. These are monkeys, of course, and we fed them lead. We do not do that to babies. We also don't know if these tau proteins would have caused dementia in the animals. So that's another big caveat.
Thank you so much, Carrie.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Carrie Grenz is an associate editor at The Scientist and a former WHYY Health and Science reporter. She keeps us updated on the latest developments in research and science. Now, let's take a look at some of the big regional health and science news. This week, more than 4,000 Princeton University students received shots of a meningitis vaccine that has yet to gain approval in the U.S. The university got special clearance from the FDA to give out the shot in response to a campus meningitis outbreak. Student Jonathan Frankel stopped in to get the shot.
There are a lot of people. It's crazy. It's crowded. They're getting people in and out very quickly, but it feels like everybody in the university is in that building right now.
Meningitis is a bacterial infection transmitted through close, constant contact, like kissing. It can be life-threatening. 8 people studying at or visiting Princeton have been diagnosed since March with a meningitis strain that the common U.S. vaccine doesn't protect against. This week also brought news in terms of pros and cons of mammograms, and you can find that story and all the other stories on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up next on The Pulse, something is growing in the basement.
With these mushrooms, harvest time is every day, multiple times a day. They're very needy. The last harvest can sometimes be midnight or after midnight, and then wake up at 6 and do it again.
That's next on The Pulse, here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca is a global biopharmaceutical business focused on the discovery and development of prescription medicines to treat the world's most serious diseases. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com.
That's guitarist Jim Hall playing the Julie Stein, Sammy Kahn song, Time After Time. Jim Hall died Tuesday at the age of 83. On the next Fresh Air, we'll listen back to our interview with him, and we'll listen back to our interview with the late lyricist Sammy Kahn. This year marked the centennial of his birth. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
A call for kindness from people who were once strangers.
We know that many people will be thinking of our children and educators and wondering how to help. We ask that you consider performing an act of kindness.
The families from Sandy Hook Elementary answer killing with kindness. We'll talk about it next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott, and we'd love to know what you think of the show. Twitter is a good way to reach us at WHYYThePulse, or post a comment on our website at whyy.org/thepulse, where you can also delve deeper into the topics from today's show. Fungi grow everywhere, even all over us, but to grow the kind you'd want to eat, it takes serious science and a lot of dedication. Kimberly Haas went to a bucolic small farm and descended into a dark, dank basement to find out more.
Of all the counties surrounding Philadelphia, Chester County has a really deep history of small farms. It makes you think of rolling landscapes, pastures with cows or horses, verdant fields. But when I visited Heather and Norm Fetter, we went down to their basement to see the crops.
So these are our bags of oyster mushrooms. These are just about ready to go into fruiting conditions. It takes about 2 weeks.
That's Norm Fetter of Woodland Jewel Mushrooms, a farm he founded 2 years ago in Spring City with his wife, Heather.
It's definitely a very different type of growing. We do tell people that we're farmers, but when I think of that, I think of bucolic landscapes and earthworms and dirt. A lot of mycology science is very sterile and very exacting, and there is a lot of laboratory-type work that goes along with it.
We're standing in one of their basement grow rooms. It looks like a crowded boxing gym with about a dozen long cylindrical bags hanging from the ceiling. Only these bags are sprouting frilly, pale gray oyster mushrooms.
Sometimes you walk into here and it feels like a rainforest and very soupy and thick. The smell is definitely a dusty type of smell. Part of what you smell in the air are the spores. Once these are fully fruited, they go into that next level of reproductive cycle where they release the spores.
And that's when we want to harvest them, is right before that spore release. That's when they're the largest, they're the most potent, the best flavor, the best color.
The warm, humid setting of the grow rooms makes the oyster mushrooms happy, but raises a challenge for the farmer.
We're creating the optimal environment for this fungus to grow, but it's also the optimal environment for every other fungus and every other type of mold to grow.
Yeah, it's really tough.
Karen Snetzelar is a mycologist, a biologist specializing in fungi at St. Joseph's University.
It does have to stay very clean, and that actually creates an environment that's very susceptible to invasion by other microbes.
It becomes a numbers and a ratio game, making sure that the one you're trying to grow is the one that wins.
Yeah.
Besides its history of small family farms, Chester County is also a major player in the mushroom industry in this country. With Woodland Jewel Mushrooms, Norm and Heather Fetter feel they've melded both traditions together, even though they arrived here in a less traditional way.
It was a hobby for about 5 years while we were living in the city. So yeah, it's been countless hours of reading, researching, note-taking, video-watching. We had to figure out all these things. We had to figure out, you know, how do we build a grow room from scratch?
Like any startup, small farms are a risky business. Norm and Heather have an advantage over other farmers, since there's no annual harvest season.
If we have failures, and we do have failures, the turnaround time is a lot quicker. You know, we get our brand new crop in there the next week. It incubates, it fruits. Hopefully, that time we recover.
On the other hand, the pace can sometimes be daunting for this two-person operation.
With these mushrooms, harvest time is every day, multiple times a day. They're very needy. Like, we have two beautiful children, but we also have hundreds of beautiful mushroom children in the basement, and they need enough fresh air, they need enough moisture, and they need to be harvested. The last harvest can sometimes be midnight or after midnight, and then wake up at 6 and do it again.
Like many small farmers, Norm and Heather have a strong commitment to the environment and sustainability. They feel their crop is the ultimate in sustainable farming.
We grow on wheat straw and rye grain. It's a way to take certain products that are left from other types of farming or growing and bring them into producing another food product out of it.
Fungi are the ultimate recyclers in nature.
Yeah, it's true. They're the decomposers of the world.
Biologist Karen Snetzelar.
All the plants and animals that live, the forest, all the leaves that fall down from the trees, the fungi are very important in breaking these things down. And so then they release those nutrients so they can be taken up and used again by plants and animals to build new life.
For The Pulse, I'm Kimberly Haas.
We've got some great pictures of those mushrooms on our website. There's one that looks more like a sea creature than a mushroom. Take a look at whyy.org/thepulse. For our next story, we entered a different kind of growing environment, not a dank basement, but a brightly lit lab with rows and rows of tiny lettuce plants sprouting in containers. Located at Penn School of Dentistry, it is the lair of Henry Daniel. He's a professor in the Department of Biochemistry and Pathology and director of translational research.
When we bring the seeds back from the greenhouse,
Daniel wears a colorful DNA helix tie. The lab is abuzz with lights, ventilators, and his energy. His passion for research is inspired by his life experience.
I was born in India. I have seen children die of cholera.
Daniel is attempting to make vaccines and medications cheaper and more accessible for people in countries like his native India.
Many of these treatments that are available here for decades are not available to the people. Globally, one-third of the global population earns $2 a day.
Which brings us back to the tiny plants growing in clear containers underneath humming neon lights.
What you see are racks of lettuce plants. To your right, you see the gene gun. this is used to fire human genes, in this case, insulin gene, and we shoot them into the plant cells. We know how to multiply them and grow them, so you see almost a whole little lettuce plant expressing human insulin in every single cell.
So what could we do with this piece of lettuce?
We harvest the lettuce leaf that we typically eat, but here these leaves will be lyophilized. That's a technical term. It's basically drying them and powdering them, and we make capsules. And those capsules are given orally, and this is to eliminate injections of insulin. Typically, an average type 1 diabetes patient would receive 50,000 injections in their lifetime. This would replace injectables.
And why the lettuce? Why can't we just take the insulin and somehow turn it into a powder and let us take it that way?
If we take insulin directly orally, we have enzymes in the stomach which will degrade the protein. So insulin is a hormone, which is a protein, and so it will never reach the bloodstream. So any plant cell, when you put the protein inside the plant cell, it has a cell wall that protects this protein from digestion. And so this insulin will be safely taken to the gut. That's where it will be absorbed.
Do all of these have insulin, or are you trying other substances as well?
Each of these shelf is for a different disease. So we have a number of different vaccines for autoimmune disorders. We also produce vaccines against infectious diseases. For example, we make a polio vaccine. We make here malaria vaccine, cholera vaccine, tuberculosis vaccine. So a number of infectious diseases vaccines are also made here.
And why, what's wrong with the vaccine? Why go through all this trouble when one could say, well, we already have something that works?
Absolutely. There's a whole lot of things wrong. If you get me started on that one. For example, take polio. There's been polio outbreak in Southeast Asia. It's jumped to Africa, vaccine derived, unfortunately. They blame it on vaccine storage, because refrigeration was not maintained, and therefore the virus in the vaccine mutated. This refrigeration is not feasible in many remote parts of the world. So our vaccines can be stored in a capsule forever. We have tested them for a few years, but they are stable, and they don't need refrigeration.
Once the lettuce plants grow and go to seed, the drug or vaccine-carrying lettuce could be regrown easily, explained Daniel, which he said would lower production costs.
For example, we have made anthrax vaccine. 1 acre can produce 320 million doses of anthrax vaccine. So this whole thing can be done in one greenhouse for a disease. And I just came back from a visit to a pharma company. They showed me these huge columns that they use to purify the proteins and make insulin, for example. And that column was $10 million, and they can use it only once. And their facility was $900 million. So this technology needs a greenhouse and a machine to make capsules. The cost of healthcare is something that really needs to be addressed.
Daniel likens this potential cost reduction to another field where prices have dropped dramatically.
The very first phone call that I made when I came from India here cost me $75. Today I'm making them free by Skype. And you can see the revolution. My phone bill was more than my rent always. So that's a technological revolution, and medicine needs that.
Henry Daniel is a professor of biochemistry and pathology at the University of Pennsylvania. Interacting with the healthcare system can be pretty annoying.
Tests.
More tests and more tests.
Referrals.
Huge bills.
I don't like dealing with copays.
In our segment, Pain in the Neck, people tell us their complaints about how things tend to happen in healthcare, and we look into why the system operates the way it does and whether anyone has a fix. Today's pet peeve, fine is a matter of definition.
I'm Dave Mozeleski. I had surgery where I had my adenoids removed, my tonsils, my deviated septum fixed, my palate adjusted, and that little punching bag thing cut out as well. The doctor called it the Roto-Rooter surgery. And when we were preparing for it, he told me that I'd be out for a week. Surgery would be done on a Friday, be out for the entire week, be fine after that. When I woke up the second Sunday after the surgery, thinking that I was going to be okay and going to work the next day, my throat was on fire, my nose was on fire, I was freaking out, painkillers weren't helping. My then-girlfriend, now wife, had to call the doctor and actually get Xanax prescribed for me because I was just such a hot mess. And when she talked to the doctor on call just said, no, they should have told him he'd be out for 2 weeks solid, because that surgery as an adult is just, no, it's not pleasant. It was the worst pain I felt in my life from after the surgery was that Sunday when I thought I was going back to work Monday. So I thought something was wrong. I thought the stitches came out. I thought it was an infection. And just mentally, I was just freaking out and really had to be reeled in and pulled back.
I think that that's true. I think it's real. Surgeons really do underestimate what's going to happen to patients.
You'll be out a week. That's it. Just take the 1 week off.
I'm Joe Beiske. I am the Associate Executive Director of the American Board of Surgery. I'm a surgeon at the University of Pennsylvania. You know, I was in practice for 20 years, not always emergency surgical services, the kind of practice where you saw the patient ahead of time, talked to them, did their surgery, and saw them after. And what I saw over time is it really takes a lot out of you, even minimally invasive surgery, which is the surgery with little incisions, which kind of gives the impression that it should be nothing. But it sets off a whole cascade of what's called a catabolic response, where your body perceives itself as having been attacked, and it changes how you use energy. And so people are very tired. They have pain a lot of the time, although that's very wildly variable how long that lasts. And often they get depressed. They have other side effects like loss of appetite, loss of food enjoyment, which in itself becomes depressing. And that all follows a pretty predictable trajectory. And I do think that surgeons neglect to tell their patients about it.
But why?
Why do we neglect to tell them about it? Well, they don't teach it in medical school, so you have to observe it and sort of pay attention to it. And so I kept hearing the same stories. You know, I'm so tired. I just feel like there must be something wrong. You know, why am I back to myself? And I just noticed, you know, I would see people 2 weeks after their surgery and 6 weeks after their surgery, and sometimes between if they were worried. And I was like, oh, you know what? They all get better. They all complain of that sort of 3.5, 4 weeks after their surgery. And then at 6 weeks, they're fine. And so I started telling them. I was like, you know, I don't think there is anything wrong with you. Why don't you call me in 2 more weeks? And because I think you're going to feel fine. And they would call and be like, you're right. You know, it just like lifted. I don't really know what happened. So then I started telling people, you know, it'll be 6 weeks before you really feel fully yourself.
Do you think surgeons maybe want to take people's fear away? You know, if you tell me beforehand, you're not going to feel well for 6 weeks, I might think, ugh. Do I want to really do the surgery at all?
So I did actually have patients. You know, some people go around and interview a lot of surgeons before they have surgery, especially for elective surgery, which is fine. And occasionally I would have someone come in. I'd say, you know, 2 weeks out of work, 6 weeks before you fully feel yourself for this operation. And that does vary according to the operation to some extent. And they'd say, well, you know, the guy down at the other hospital told me, you know, 2 days out of work and, you know, I'd be fine in a week. So why should I come to you? And I was like, it's not a difference in the operation, you know, it's a difference in the preparation. So I don't know. I do think that surgeons as a breed, you know, we kind of take it on the chin ourselves. You know, most of us trained in an era of time when you worked 120 or 140 hours a week. There's a lot of self-sacrifice. You went to work sick. You went to work in pain. You went to work on crutches when you broke your leg. So I think there's a little bit of a, I can do it, you can do it too. And I think we generally don't see people in the suffering phase. It's not that it's malevolent or reckless. I think it's just somewhat uninformed. We have this like, you're going to be fine, you're going to be fine, you're going to be fine. And they are going to be fine. It's just going to take them a little bit longer than they expect.
Are surgeons as a group talking about this? Is there any interest in maybe informing patients better or having longer conversations?
I'm going to have to say no. It's just, you know, they just don't perceive it as really a problem. As long as in the long run you're okay, and as long as you've got some sort of way to take care of yourself. You know, no surgeon likes to discharge a patient to home alone. Most hospitals don't really allow that. There's supposed to be someone to be with you. And so we just figure someone will take care of it. They'll get better. We'll hear about it if they don't get better. That's sort of where it lies. I don't think there is much thrust on better education.
So do you have any advice for patients who are going into surgery? So if the surgeon says this, and maybe they're hearing from other people who've gone through that surgery who say a totally different thing, where do I find the truth?
Well, so you should listen to your friends who've been through something similar, because most surgeons have not had all the operations that they do. Everything should be taken seriously. You should count on it taking longer to recover than you think it will. And you cannot win by pushing. You can't win by pushing. You have to relax and let nature take its course. So, you know, again, I would say 2 weeks before you can really functionally do a good job at a desk job, longer if you do a physical job, 6 weeks before you're really truly yourself again.
Joe Bieske from the American Board of Surgery. What's your pain in the neck? That thing that really annoys you about doctors' offices, hospitals, insurers, or whatever? Email us at thepulse@whyy.org. And we always enjoy hearing from you. Last week's story by Zach Seward on medical billing yielded lots of response. Zach took us to a local firm that will do battle with hospitals to explain and reduce people's bills. But listener Bernie wrote in with this point. What do you do when you can't even get a look at your bill? When he asked a hospital for a copy of the itemized charges from a surgical stay, he was told you can get it, but only if you pay $120. We called Steve Kelly from ELAB Services, the Chester County firm Zach profiled in his story on medical billing, and Steve said getting a copy of your bill is a perfectly reasonable thing to ask for.
Many of these bills total $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000 to ask for a line item. Frankly, I think, you know, every employer and every employee should be asking for these. We might not be in the mess we're in if we were all taking a closer look at what the actual unit costs of health care are.
We also talked to the hospital where Bernie said he encountered this problem, and they told us they don't usually charge patients for itemized bills, and they promised they would investigate this issue when they had more information on the specific bill in question. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our assistant producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Elizabeth Perez-Luna directed today's show. Chris Satullo is our vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. We'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback or suggestions at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.